Listen, learn, and enjoy.
It's the Lisa Show.
With Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. The Lisa Show is happening now.
Is there a way to tell if a product on Amazon has really reliable reviews? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to learn how to tell. And then did you know that a lot of fast food chains have secret menus? Well, I'm going to tell you what big dessert you can get at McDonald's on their secret menu. That's coming up in 15 minutes in your morning buzz.
Bringing a new life into the world is one of the most exciting moments in a young parent's life. You're ready to give them the world, protect them from any harm that could come upon them. Unfortunately, though, we can't always protect our children from everything. Eli was born in 2019 with a rare disorder that is currently incurable. His dad, Scott Reich, still wanting to do all that he could for his son, made it his mission to start the nonprofit called Believe in a Cure, to focus on funding and spreading awareness.
Scott's here with us today to tell us more about what this disorder is and what Believe in a Cure is doing to help. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me on.
For those who maybe don't know, could you tell us a little bit more about what Fox GI syndrome is?
Sure. So Fox G1 syndrome is a rare brain disorder that's caused by a mutation in the Fox G1 gene. So what that means in lay terms is that there's a typo, meaning there's a letter that's either missing or extra or that's in the wrong place. And as a result, the gene does not create the right protein that it's supposed to. And there's a lot of downstream impacts. And so as a consequence of having a typo in this gene, you have patients that are unable to walk, talk, feed themselves, do anything really independently. They suffer seizures. They have a sleep disorder. It's a neurological condition, and so everything is impacted.
How common is it?
It's pretty rare. There are under 1,000 known patients in the entire world, although that number is increasing due to access to genetic testing. As you might expect, a lot of rare diseases are underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed.
Yeah.
And so there are anticipated to be thousands of people, but nonetheless, it's rare.
Is it something that's diagnosed in utero or is it not until birth?
It's not until after birth. That's not to say that it's impossible to diagnose in utero, but as you can also imagine, there are thousands of genes that lead to rare conditions when there's a problem.
Yeah.
And so the panels that women are able to test for during pregnancy are limited to the more common conditions. So unless you know to search for something that's very rare, which nobody does, because how would you know about it in advance, then you don't find it. And so this is something that presents after birth and ultimately leads parents down a path to ultimately get genetic testing, and then they get a diagnosis.
So tell us a little bit more about your story. And what life is like for your son, Eli.
Sure. So there's a couple of pieces to it. Life for Eli is pretty tough. He just turned 2 years old about a month ago, and he is really unable to do very much. I mean, developmentally, he's probably about 4 or 5 months on the developmental scale. And he requires 24/7 care. He has suffered seizures that have brought us to the hospital many times. And, you know, we live to some degree in fear and anxiety that things are going to go off the rails at any point. And unfortunately, some patients with the condition have died. But we don't want to be defined by the negativity. And so that's really the bigger part of our story, which is that we tried to convert our grief and sadness and frustration and anger into action. And so we formed a nonprofit foundation called Believe in a Cure. And our focus is to raise funding to actually sponsor research from leading scientists around the world to develop a treatment, because one does not exist today.
How does that work? And more particularly, is it like, well, listen, our child has Fox G1 and we'd really like some people to research that. Here's some money. Like what are the fundamentals of how this works?
You raise a good point, and it's difficult to do that, especially in a global pandemic, because you're trying to find scientists who have expertise in the condition of interest. And when you have a very rare disease, there are not too many scientists that have really looked at it, and certainly not too many companies, because a small patient population means that there's not as much money to be made commercially from a potential drug. So what we've had to do over the last year and a half or so has been travel around the world, or during the pandemic, have a lot of virtual meetings and find out who are the scientific experts who can translate their expertise into something about this disease. So we've had to recruit people to the field. And what we do is we go to universities where these scientists work. And basically, they submit proposals to us. We have an advisory board of scientists that helps us review the proposals to vet them. And then we ultimately go to contract with the scientists for the different projects, which range from developing cell lines and mouse models to actually developing drugs from scratch. So it's quite a quite a wide process.
It's such a huge undertaking. And for those who are unfamiliar with the undertaking that we're talking about, we're speaking with Scott Reich, who's the founder of Believe in a Cure, which is a nonprofit foundation seeking to cure FOXG1 syndrome, which is a rare brain disorder that affects about 700 children worldwide. You know, to say, hey, we're recruiting people into the field. We have an advisory board. We're contracting them to research. This is a major undertaking while simultaneously caring for your son. I'm wondering what you have learned over the last couple of years about going through a situation like this, and advice that you'd have for families going through similar situations that have children struggling with a disorder or a disability, who are trying to look for some hope.
In an ironic way, this has been the most inspirational and adventurous journey that I've ever been on, and same for my wife. Don't get me wrong, we would trade anything in the world not to be on this journey.
Of course.
But now that we're here, what I would say is that we have been exposed to the most unbelievable people and minds in the world. And it has really opened our eyes to the beauty around us and how much there is to be grateful for. And I don't mean to sound, you know, kind of just, oh, isn't it la-di-da, isn't it wonderful? I certainly don't feel that. We're devastated by this diagnosis, which is why we're working so hard to develop a treatment that will help save our son and other kids who are impacted. But what I mean is that we have seen so much generosity, so much charity. Yeah. The community has rallied around us to provide financial support to help us fund this work, which we invite people to do at WeBelieveInACure.org. But at the end of the day, the advice that I have for folks is twofold. One is stay positive and sort of focus on the short term rather than the long term. If you're like me, you're a planner and you think further ahead about what your career is going to be, what your family is going to be, where you're going to live and all these things. And this changes the trajectory and prism through which you look at life. You have to look at a shorter time horizon, and doesn't mean we don't plan for future things, but we have to focus on the present and getting through the day and the week and sometimes the hour. The other thing is that there is tremendous hope that is genuine out there right now based on incredible advances in science. And so people that have a diagnosis it is not crazy to think that we will have cures and treatments for lots of rare diseases in the next few years. Things that were sci-fi just 5 years ago are now going into the clinic, and they're real based on what the field has been able to achieve. So never give up hope.
Well, and a real great example that I don't think anyone is unaware of is, you know, the advances as far as the immunizations for COVID, right? Where people were saying, oh, normally this would be years and years in less than a year to be able to advance, and some of the things that have come about through that. I would be curious, Scott, in engaging this with your child, and certainly being able to get to know other families that have someone in their family, one of their loved ones that has been diagnosed with this disease as well, it would be very easy to be hopeless, to give up, to say, oh, you know, we're a victim of our circumstances. In those times when it is most difficult for you, how do you persist? How do you push through it?
There's an old saying that Franklin Roosevelt had made famous, which was, when you're going through hell, keep going. So I try to just focus on, hey, we're going to get through this and stay positive. There are certainly moments of doubt, and there are certainly moments of pain and sadness, and they're all too frequent. But I try to keep for me, I try to keep my eyes on the prize, which is, I'm waking up every day with a mission, and that is to develop a treatment. And there's going to be bumps along the way. It's going to be challenging, and we don't know exactly what the outcome is going to be. But I feel confident in the ability and capacity for humans to come together and build a sense of community, not only of support, but also to do things that are perceived to be impossible. I mean, the whole nature of the word impossible, the whole concept, in my view, is fiction. And the idea of impossible is simply something that has not happened yet. And so with advances going on at the pace that they are, and you raise a good point about what this pandemic has shown us, mm-hmm. which is that the world can come together and do something incredible and formidable and in unbelievable timeframes. And in fact, I think that's one of the major takeaways for me of what the world has gone through recently, which is that there is something unifying about science, right? I mean, when other patients and us, no one asked us before my son was diagnosed, who did you vote for in the last election? Where do you live? What do you do for a living? Mm-hmm. What teams do you root for? None of that, right? It happened at random. It could happen to anybody. And there's something that brings people together regardless of our values, our station in life. And science is an opportunity for people to come together around shared concern. And I think that, if anything, the pandemic has shown us that we need to invest more in the scientific community globally.
And it's, I'd also like to point out that it's very inspirational and encouraging to have someone like yourself who is in the middle of fighting and caring for, you know, your sweet son who is battling this right now. And there is something about a sense of urgency that comes from you that is inspiring for other people to want to help, right? You know, no one would fault you for just focusing on your son, right, and your own family. But the fact that you're turning it outward and trying to help so that this doesn't happen to someone else, so that when a diagnosis like this comes to another family, that they have made scientific, you know, strides or cures or treatments, that you are fighting for it right now is quite remarkable.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think you've touched on something important, which is that I think among the hardest things that we've done have actually not been recruiting the scientists or even raising the money necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, those are not easy. But I think that the most difficult piece for families that are going through this kind of challenge is the ability to turn outward and to open oneself up and embrace, you know, their vulnerability. I mean, that took us some time. Yeah. And I think that what we've learned from it is that the things that we were scared of, the things that we feared, don't really come to fruition, because the people who step up to the plate are your true friends and family. And those are the people you want to be around. So I think that for those people who are suffering and who are going through, you know, the biggest takeaway for me is don't do it alone. And, you know, really try to connect with other people. And so in our case, you know, it costs a lot of money to do the research that we're pursuing. We have a fundraising target of $7 million. And as I mentioned earlier, big pharmaceutical companies are less interested in rare diseases because the commercial payoff isn't there. Mm-hmm. We've raised about $2 million in a year during the pandemic without an event, and just by virtue of the generosity of other people and feeling connected. And, you know, even though they may not have heard of our disease, they seem inspired by our story and our willingness to fight.
Give us the call to action. If people are inspired by your story, by what you've told us, how can we help?
The most important thing for us is continuing to accelerate our research through funding. And so we invite people to visit our website, webelieveinacure.org. Again, that's webelieveinacure.org, where you can learn more about our work, learn more about this condition and our efforts. And if you feel inclined to support us, we're grateful for every contribution. Truly, every dollar matters.
Scott Reich, the co-founder of Believe in a Cure, that nonprofit. It's webelieveinacure.org. Scott, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up in 5 minutes, we're going to learn how to never be fooled by a fake online review again. And in your morning buzz, do you want to try a new treat this weekend? I'm going to tell you about the dessert that you can get at McDonald's on their secret menu, the one that you didn't know was an option. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Are you so excited to be able to see live plays and musicals again? Well, coming in 20 minutes, we're going to be here about how live theater is opening back up and what you need to know before you go. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Lisa V. That's right. I'm taking over the morning buzz today and bringing you three stories, three kind of ideas that you're going to want to talk about. Kind of buzz around about that water cooler talk that makes you sound informed and interesting. There's a lull in the conversation. Don't worry. We got some ideas of things to talk about today. The first one, you know, we always say celebrities, they're just like us. But I don't know. This story that's trending makes me rethink that. Selma Hayek recently on a new interview with Kelly Clarkson said that she was really confused when she tried Taco Bell for the first time. You know, she grew up in Mexico, when she visited her aunt in Houston, Texas, she went to Taco Bell and she's like, they gave us these hard shell tacos. I've never seen that in my life. They don't exist in Mexico. It's always with a soft taco. Well, in this interview that's trending, she talks about how it just was really, really confusing. And I just think, okay, a celebrity's going to sound really out of touch if they say they don't understand Taco Bell. Now, according to a deep dive into the history of the taco, which, of course, I had to take, some people say, listen, it's inspired by tacos dorados, fried tacos from Mexico, which date back to the 1890s. So, yeah, they did exist in Mexico. Another story reports that crispy tacos were popular in Texas and California in the early 1940s. Now, Glenn Bell, who would later become the founder of Taco Bell, started selling them in the 1950s chain restaurant called Taco Tia, which later became Taco Bell. Now, also, you know, on this day in history, June 17th, but in 1885, today marks the day that the Statue of Liberty was delivered. You know, it was our nice 151-foot-high gift from the French people. It arrived in New York. There was a lot of brouhaha, if you will, about the base and who was going to pay for that pedestal. It went back and forth, and ultimately, Joseph Pulitzer of the New York World started a donation drive, and it got a lot of contributors to donate the $102,000 that were needed at the time to make the pedestal. Now, on that pedestal is inscribed the poem, you know, you've heard it, by Emma Lazarus. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. That's on this day in history. And finally, maybe you've heard a lot of fast food restaurants have a secret menu. Did you know McDonald's has a secret menu? Well, what dessert can you order? Well, thanks to a popular TikTok user, Kaylee Weeks, she posted a video claiming that at McDonald's, you can get $9 chocolate cakes with white frosting and an image of Ronald McDonald. That's right. McDonald's sells birthday cakes for $9 on its secret menu. Now, when they asked, is this really true? And McDonald's, the spokespeople, came out and said, listen, yeah, but they're not available at every location. You kind of have to ask. But you know what? Like my dad always told me growing up, if you don't ask, it's not going to happen. There's no harm in asking, right? So occasionally, the restaurants have decided to let customers purchase this cake for their birthdays. But they're not on the official menu. I gotta get to the bottom of this, though. Because like a birthday cake from McDonald's, why not? With the image of Ronald McDonald on it, $9. Now, lots of restaurants have secret menus. If you didn't know, Disney Springs announced it has a secret menu, a watermelon dole that's going to be available for a limited time. Starbucks has a secret menu, In-N-Out, Chipotle. So, you know, next time you go out, maybe this weekend, ask for a secret item menu. Maybe the employees will know, but at least, maybe they won't, but at least you know it's possible. Maybe not at every location, but having your dream birthday cake ordered from McDonald's may actually be a dream no more and be a reality. And that is your morning buzz. In today's digital world, online reviews are often the ultimate factor in deciding whether or not you buy a product. Now, understanding these reviews used to be simple. If it had 105 star reviews, it's reliable. If it has 8 reviews, they're all below 3 stars, you know, just to kind of move on. But as more and more people have started using fake reviews to boost their numbers, it's hard to know what to believe what we read online anymore. So how can we know when to trust these reviews? Today, we're joined by Saud Khalifa, the founder of a review tracking software called FakeSpot, here to talk with us about recognizing authentic reviews. Welcome, Saud.
Thank you very much for having me, Lisa and Richie.
So how common is it for a product on websites like Amazon or Yelp to have fake reviews?
Well, over the last couple of years, it has become, unfortunately, way more common than it should be.
And so who is buying these fake reviews? Who's generating it?
So a lot of these sellers that are on Amazon will want to buy fake reviews to pump the rating for their product, so that more people, you know, go through and actually get to read the reviews, and then they're more incentivized to buy that product.
And so how are they created? Like, how do people make fake reviews on a large volume like this?
So there's two ways that fake reviews can be made. The first method is using bots, and it's basically robots that generate fake reviews around a template that the seller will provide to a service. And usually we call these services fake review farms. And they're located internationally, and you can hire them. Actually, you're one Google search away from hiring them. So that's
really?
The first category.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting industry, to say the least. And that's the first category,
okay.
And it can pump a lot of volume of fake reviews towards the product when you hire these services.
Mm-hmm.
The second category, and I would say the more insidious, because it's a very stealthy way of having fake reviews, is the promotional reviews category.
Mm-hmm.
And these are actually reviews written by humans that have received the product for free or received some kind of compensation to write a 5-star review for the seller.
So then how can we tell whether it's the first kind generated by AI or by a promotional slash kind of trade for review? How can we tell those from those other reviews, which are people that have either shopped a product or a service and really feel passionate to tell other people about it?
Yeah, so it's getting harder to actually analyze the latter part, the promotional reviews from people that received products for free or something like that, because they sound really, really authentic.
Mm.
But when you dig into their reviewer profile, for example, or when you look up, the details in the review, you can see that there are specifics that mention that it's a promotional review in its own nature. Regarding the AI-generated or the bot-generated reviews, you can see certain blips within the system. And by blips, I mean grammar mistakes, typos, spelling mistakes, non-native cadence on the language. So those kinds of things are red flags whenever you're reading these kinds of reviews.
And when we're talking about the promotional reviews, are we talking about influencers and people with large followings? Because I was under the impression that they had to be upfront, hey, this is a paid promotional.
Yes.
Are there laws? And if so, what are the parameters?
Yes, there are consumer laws. So the consumer law is you need to specify in your, let's say it's a written review, you need to specify that you received a compensation or some kind of incentive to write this review. You need to put a disclaimer either at the beginning or at the end of the review or somewhere within. If you don't provide this disclaimer, then it's now violating the regulation. So that's where a lot of the consumers, they fall into a trap. They don't know that this review was, from a promotional campaign.
You know what I found interesting is that this has come to light recently in the news as well. There was the story of the seeds that were coming out of China that were sent randomly to people's homes, and that had something to do with reviews and sites. Are you aware of that story?
Yes, I'm very aware of that story. So I believe it was happening on eBay, if I'm not mistaken. And these sellers from China were sending, I think a majority of the packages were seeds, for your garden or something like that.
Uh-huh.
None of them were ordered by people, but these sellers wanted reviews in return for, getting a product for free. And they would provide a link or some kind of, description where they could leave that review. Richie, to add something to your discovery, the place where most of these promotional reviews are happening is actually on Facebook groups.
Hmm.
So if you go
really?
To Facebook, yeah, like right now, if you go to a Facebook group, we do this as part of our investigation because we want to be 10 steps ahead of all these fraudsters. And there are literally these groups with thousands of members where these sellers, usually from China, talk to consumers in the United States, and they tell them, hey, we will PayPal you $100 if you get this product, order it through Amazon, and actually leave a review for us. If you do this, we will compensate you for the review.
Oh, wow.
We're talking with Sayyid Khalifa about online reviews. Now, in addition to working here, Sayyid, I also run a private service business that is really based a lot on reviews. People can hire me for weddings or for parties. And it has become imperative that when I provide that service to people to be able to get a review. Why do we trust reviews of other people so much?
Well, in the digital front, you can't really, when you're window shopping in physical form, you are able to, you know, touch, feel, look at the product, talk to the salesman, and then, you can gauge that through physical form. On the digital front, you are unable to do that. You need to rely on the opinion and the reputation that is, you know, written out in front of you, or actually, if you're looking at a video review, you're listening to it and watching what this person says. But that's the whole problem right now. A lot of people understand for them to gain a sale, for them to gain a reservation or something like that, the better the reviews look, the better the ratings look, the higher the chance they will get that commission or that reservation.
You know, it's so overwhelming because it seems like these things change so quickly. And like you're saying, you know, you're anticipating new trends as these bots or these influencers get more and more savvy in the way that they generate these fake reviews. The ones that the very ones that we are relying on to sort of save us that research time. And you founded a review tracking software, FakeSpot, just a few years ago. How does it work and what factors do you consider?
So, that's a great question. I actually started the website after being ripped off myself.
Really?
So I was just finishing up my master's degree in software engineering. And, you know, I've been a huge fan of AI. I've always been building programs. And at this time, I ordered this supplement from Amazon. It had hundreds of five-star reviews. Mm-hmm. And when I got it in physical form, this supplement looked like someone created it as a side project in the garage. It had flimsy tape just, plastered on. And then I looked at the pill content. I was really interested to see this. They put in a carpentry dust from a wood shop into the pill content. So, to me, immediately I had red flags in my mind. I knew that there's no way this could have hundreds of five-star reviews, people saying that this is a good thing. There's no chance.
There's no way.
So I went back. Yeah, I read all the reviews, looked at the reviewer profiles, and I saw that they were all bot-generated. And that's how FakeSpot started. I created the website for me and my family and friends, and so that I wouldn't spend hours of my time just, you know, trying to research if these reviews I'm reading are real.
Right.
I don't think we have that much time just to shop online. Mm-hmm. So that's how FakeSpot started. And FakeSpot right now can be used as a Chrome extension if you use a Google Chrome browser, or it could be used on FakeSpot.com, the website itself. And how you can use it is if you have the Chrome extension installed, we will actually show our grades around any product you're browsing on Amazon and tell you if you can trust the reviews in real time with the Chrome extension. If you do not want to use the Chrome extension, you can literally just paste in the product link on FakeSpot.com, and we will analyze in real time all the reviews and actually show you a really cool analysis progress of how we read the reviews, how our AI engines read it in, and then spit out the result at the end. And then you can be the judge if you can trust the reviews using the data points from FakeSpot.
What's the retribution for these companies? Like, you're able to identify, hey, these are fake. Is there something that we can do? Or are you just sounding the trumpet saying, stay away from these companies?
So we're just providing a guidance when you're shopping online.
Sure.
So here's the thing. The state of affairs in this year, and we've had a really weird year, but even the most reputable companies that you know of have promotional reviews right now on their product listings. And that's the problem because...
Oh, like you're saying everyone's doing it.
Pretty much, yes. Ugh. Because they need to compete with each other. And now this is the problem. How many of you have you ever seen an average one-star review rating a product on Amazon? Have you
no.
ever seen one?
Yeah. I don't think so, now that you say
we've never seen that because when you're shopping online, it's for Amazon's benefit, it's for the brand's benefit, it's for everyone's benefit that is involved on the business side to paint this perfect picture, you know, positive world. Hey, just come and buy this, purchase this, add this to your cart, and check out, please. But the thing is, we all know that the world doesn't work that way. It's not realistic. You know, there are products that fail, there are products that are bad, and they just need to be said that they're bad. But we never see this.
You're right. Now that you say it, I'm sort of enraged by that. Like, if there are lots of five stars, there has to be a one star, right, but there's not. So how do we change the system, or is this something that we just have to get used to?
Well, I hope that's not something we need to get used to, because if as more of us are shopping online, especially with the pandemic right now, we're doing a lot of things online, right? I don't think it's a good look for all these platforms when everything is so positive. And I'm not just talking about Amazon. I'm even talking about Apple App Store.
Sure.
So, you know, every single app, every single product looks so good. And there's a problem, because that's not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's where FakeSpot, what we're trying to do with the company is we're trying to bring back trust and transparency to this process. And we're trying to basically overhaul this review system, because we think there's a lot of flaws with it. And it actually, you know, the roots of the five-star rating system has its roots in the 1800s, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, it was started by a newspaper in Manhattan when it was still a Dutch colony, I believe, or right after. And it reviewed hostels on the island.
Oh, how funny. I had no idea that it was so old. Well, okay, so if we don't feel confident going on site reviews, where else can we go to find reliable reviews for products?
So if you're buying a very expensive product and you're going to, you know, dash out a couple hundred dollars, I think it's very important to have a couple of places where you're actually getting a better picture of what the product is like, the reputation of the brand. And also the wider array of places you're researching, the better idea you'll have about the product. So by that, I mean, try to search for video reviews. If this kind of product exists, someone is reviewing it in person, they can't really lie. You know, they're holding the product, they're using it.
Yeah.
They could use it and show it on the video. And then you can look at it and you're like, okay, cool. This makes sense. Also try to find blogs from people that are specializing in that kind of product category, let's say fitness watches. And it's a blog related to fitness watches, and you're reading someone's review on it. So the more sources you have, the more places you're looking at, I think that's more reliable than just looking at Amazon reviews and just limiting yourself to that, you know, that sphere.
Sayoud, we have about 1 minute left with you, and in that time, I'm hoping you can tell me about the most outlandish or craziest or just, I can't even believe this is on the internet type
listing
of thing.
Yeah, that's a great question. We recently saw an N95 mask being sold on Amazon. It was on Amazon, and it had hundreds of five-star reviews, but all the reviews were for a book about the Constitution.
The reviews had nothing to do with the product. That is funny.
Nothing.
Nothing to do.
So it's like they're not even trying now.
Or
we're so dumb.
They? We'll just... Or is it symbolic? That's interesting. That it just had nothing
really
to do with the actual product.
Oh, wow. That
and
is.
I think it's ironic with the current situation.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Pretty funny.
A tremendous resource for people who just, you know, want to avoid getting ripped off like you did.
Yeah.
Sayoud Khalifa is the founder of FakeSpot. It's a browser extension that tests the accuracy and authenticity of online reviews. You can check out the extension and also visit their website at fakespot.com.
Now, while you're online, hop on over to byuradio.org/adventure and enter for a chance to win as part of Lisa's Adventure Club, an annual National Parks family pass. We're giving away one pass every week throughout the summer so that you can go out and take adventures with your family, with a group of friends. And that annual pass, Parks Pass, it'll let you go anywhere, you know, across the country. So many different parks to go and discover and see. And here on The Lisa Show, as part of Lisa's Adventure Club, we are highlighting a lot of them. We will be all summer long to inspire you for different ways to do that. Now, when you go to enter for a chance to win on our website at byuradio.org, you will see a lot of different ways that you can enter. And it's really easy to understand if you just hop on over there. But one of the ways that you can get additional entries is by having a secret password. This week's secret word, are you ready? Is boots. So you're listening. You get another chance to enter for a chance to win as part of Lisa's Adventure Club. Now, coming up next, hear about all of the adaptations that the theaters have made over the past year and about the state of stages as they begin to slowly open back up across the country. We're going to get you ready for live theater. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Now, when the trajectory of the pandemic became clear over a year ago, live theater shut down overnight. And since then, the theater community has been working to find a way to get stages to open back up safely and for good. This summer and fall, professional theaters are starting to open up, but things are going to look a little different in order to make that happen. So if you are wondering what is going to be available, where can I go, what will it be like? Well, here to tell us about that progress and what you can expect as an audience member is Michael Barr. Michael's the education director at the Utah Shakespeare Festival and has been working along with a lot of others in the community to bring back live theater. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much.
Now,
yes, it's going to happen.
I love your enthusiasm. And I think, you know, audiences across the country have been waiting. You know, when can we buy our tickets? How can we support live theater, this art form that wasn't able to exist for a while? And I'd love to know that about your experience with it, kind of setting the stage, pun intended, for this rollout. You know, the shutdown began as at the theater that you work. You guys were starting rehearsals. You know, we're going to go back a year and several months back. What was that like, though, from an administrative point of view?
Yeah, so about a year and a month ago, I still remember being in our office, and the pandemic has taken a number of different kind of phases. If we remember what it was all like in February of last year, and then March, and then as things started to shut down, we had a touring production of Romeo and Juliet that was actually going out to the schools. We had just come through the Vegas area, across through the tribal Navajo reservation schools, and had just come into town, and we were going to sit down for about a week, and then we were going to go up thinking that the pandemic would just move on. And then that opportunity closed. We were planning on the summer season, planning on having 9 shows, and as the pandemic's progressed, we went, well, this is not going to be possible. We actually had hired a number of technicians to start building the sets. And then we went, well, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Let's modify. And so we modified and we went, okay, now we're only going to offer 3 shows. We'll keep them outside because at that time we said, you know, we can't be in buildings, but we'll be able to keep these outside. And then even that changed until eventually, literally about a year ago now, we said it's not possible and we had to cancel the season. And
wow.
It wasn't just us. I mean, all across the country, as you shared, Broadway, major theme parks, who also carry professional actor equity contracts, were not allowed to open. And it was very difficult to do that because of the parameters and the safety protocols that had been established. And so, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that is just a logistical nightmare just from all this pivoting of, oh, we'll try this and now we'll try 3 shows. Well, we'll stay outside, and being able to adjust like that from an administrative point of view would be very stressful as we all watched the development of the virus and certainly everyone's reaction. What was that like for, like you mentioned, the actors, the creators, and the creatives who rely on this for their livelihood?
Yeah, I mean, you used the word of the year, pivot.
Yeah.
So, which many times we're tired of doing. I think teachers are heroes. Many other great essential workers in this. And I find that the creatives, and I'm glad you mentioned creatives, so these are designers, these are technicians, these are actors who, for their lifetimes, I mean, highly, highly articulate, educated individuals who were then not able to find work.
Yeah.
And, you know, they leave the Utah Shakespeare Festival. It's not like they can go, you know, back to Chicago or L.A. To do something. There was just no work. And I have so many friends, and I'm sure you do too, who... this skill set of acting and designing and building changed. And so there were a lot of people, and we saw a lot of these products happening in about June, July, August. We said, okay, well, let's find a different medium. And so some started to do Zoom plays. Others did radio plays. There were drive-in theaters. In October, there was a production of Macbeth that went on in Kentucky where They set up socially distant rehearsals. They designed masks and costumes that actually looked kind of apocalyptic. You allow them to wear masks. You would pull up, you would tune into your radio, and you could watch it from a distance. I mean, there were so many different ways we were trying to adapt within this time. The actors themselves, many of them had to go out and find other types of jobs. I have a very good friend who, you know, his wife went into teaching, and he went into postal service so that they could do postal work, just trying to find some other way to create and adapt. Mm-hmm. Universities and academic systems found the same challenge, too, because there were people who had four-year degrees that were looking to get through, and it, you know, had to turn into either a Zoom format or a radio format or radio broadcast, and not being able to do that. And we're very, very fortunate, I'm going to use the word blessed, that our company has found a way to reopen and to receive permission from the union to make this happen for this upcoming year, too, as well.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to be able to explain what that the last year and a handful of months have been like for a major, you know, industry, the theater industry, and how it affects so many people, how you've been able to pivot. And if you're just joining in on the conversation, we're talking with Michael Barr, who's the education director at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, about their pivot and pivot again, and how they've been able to adjust and what it's been like, because I feel like you really are creating this excitement that as theater goers and as consumers we feel about thinking, okay, hey, now these shows that have been shut down, these beautiful, you know, the sound design and lighting design and costume design that everyone's been sitting on, we can finally see it and it in a safe way. So I'd love to be able to then now focus the rest of our conversation on theaters opening up and what that will look like.
Yeah. So we're sitting on designs. We have these designs for a year. Then we modify the designs and say, okay, this is how we'll do it this way. And we say, no, that doesn't work, and then complete shutdown. Mm-hmm. So after that happens, we said, okay, what's the way we can modify? And then we said, okay, world's opening back up. We think this is possible. We re-engaged many of the artists and designers we weren't able to engage. We were able to engage some of them. Some chose to come back. Some had other positions that they couldn't hold. But we put the designs in place. We can make that happen. But the key for us, and there have been other theaters that have found ways to kind of navigate through the crisis, and I want to give credit to them as they were doing it. The challenge with our theater is, and others like us, and I include Broadway, theme parks, and anyone who is in the regional theater world, is that missing component of the equity contract. And so we have these equity contracts. Our actors are equity professional actors, and they are trying to protect their actors and making sure that there are certain protocols that are followed to make that happen. And those are huge. And I don't think many times we never find out how the sausage is made.
Yeah.
and we don't know all of the things that an organization has to go through to make that happen. So I'm just going to rattle off a few of those. First,
no,
of all,
please do, because I think that a lot of people don't understand what an equity contract entails.
Yeah. So in addition to all of the regular things that are required by a theater company to have equity union members work in their company, there are now health protocols that are placed on top of that. And so we had to create three different bubbles. One which was called the testing group, group one, which was all of the acting company and anyone who came in direct contact with the acting company. And that had to be a completely vaccinated company. And so that's that group of individuals. So the number's about 90. We have 350 total employees in our company. Then there was the kind of production, which interacted with actors, but also interacted with public, et cetera. And then there was the outward facing audience. And we called those three different bubbles that we had to do. We have weekly testing protocols. So in other words, once a week, every one of these, even vaccinated, need to make sure that they are tested to make sure that they don't have COVID, just to keep everybody safe. And then all of our administrative spaces, our rehearsal spaces, our production spaces are closed off to the public.
and we are all masked during this time. So while within the state of Utah, those mask mandates have lessened, it's a very, very different standard for those of us that are working here within the theater industry. So, you know, you'll come in, you'll don your mask, you'll work, you'll engage that way and do it. The actors themselves within rehearsals are not wearing masks mm-hmm. In this vaccinated group. And good news, 2 weeks ago, we are a member of LORT, the League of Regional Theaters, and their lawyers have been talking to equities lawyers to kind of lift mask mandates for audience members. 2 weeks ago, all audience members were required to wear masks. And that changed to all vaccinated or not. And now we have opened up so that all outdoor performances, and we have many outdoor performances, mm-hmm. all outdoor performances, audience members are not required to wear masks. If they're not vaccinated, they're recommended, but again, it's not required. And then our indoor spaces are still required to wear masks. But we believe, mm-hmm. and we believe this very, very strongly, and we believe that by the time our season opens, we open on Monday, and then we get a different contract. Again, a lot of legal stuff that's happening here. But the 1st of July, we believe that that mandate will be lifted wow. completely. But presently, so again, it's an ever-changing, mm-hmm. Evolving landscape. So presently, we know all of the outdoors, the green show, et cetera. Audiences are not wearing masks. We know in indoor spaces they are. But we believe that with the changes that are happening within the union, that will be given back to local control. And I don't think that's something that a lot of people understand, that we're a nation here of many, many different both cultural things that are affecting us and also health things that are affecting mm-hmm. So New York and L.A. and Georgia look very, very different than Utah and Nevada and Idaho. But we are working with both unions and artists that come from a number of different areas.
That's a good point.
Navigating all of that is different. So Broadway, you've probably seen the news, is scheduled to open in September. Mm-hmm. But there are off-Broadway houses and other houses that are finding ways to start to open those spaces, too. And then you throw the art on top of that,
yeah.
working with the art and that. And I have to tell you, I've been to the 1st dress rehearsals, and it is thrilling to be in a house
oh,
and to hear
I bet.
Those words. There's weeping at the end, you know, as people are saying, oh, wow, look at that. You know, hear that. I have to tell you about a really fun story. So after going through all these protocols, they had to have vaccinated. A lot of the rollout in Utah for vaccinations was very well executed, and people were able to get them here, but they were not able to get vaccinations in other places.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were many actors who arrived for their first day of contract but had to spend the first 2 weeks
oh.
of their contract
yeah.
rehearsing from Zoom and not able to be in the room
wow.
where the other rehearsals were going on. So when they finally came into the room, and there was a stage manager is helping them. They're dancing, and they say, once you get done with dancing, we'd like you to move over to the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take a 10? And an actor said, I just took a 15-month 10. I don't need a 10.
Oh.
Please let me come over to the piano.
Oh.
And then they started weeping
and
crying as they all came together, you know, mm-hmm. to share. So it's and there's muscles that these actors have to get. I mean, mm-hmm. imagine anything that you're doing, and then all of a sudden you immediately stop doing
yeah.
it, and then you go back to doing it again. And if any of you know anything about the Utah Shakespeare Festival schedule, I mean, we're working 10 out of 12 hours, you know, within the day
yeah.
as they're doing that. I mean, an actor's life is, you know, when they're singing and dancing and sharing all
yeah.
of that. Those are muscles that need to be executed and used. So, yeah, it's thrilling.
It's exciting to hear the development of this, because we really are in an exciting time where we're all anticipating this. And like you mentioned, across the country, it looks different depending
yes.
on where you're going to go. And so I think people are looking to different places that have opened up and said, what is this going to be like? So what do you say to that when you're looking to walk into a professional theater? What can you expect?
Yes. If you're walking into a professional theater presently, and this is pretty much the same across the nation right now, any professional theater that's outside
you are not masked as an audience member. I can say that about TourCon. I can say that about us. I can say that about other performance venues, too. Indoor spaces, I'm talking about my friends in Denver. I'm talking about my friends in Chicago. In spaces, you're still masked as an audience member. And I do believe that within our contract shifts at the end of June, and I do believe that indoor spaces will be shifting, much like they have in California, to what I'm going to call a mask-friendly environment. In other words, if you're not vaccinated, we'd recommend that you wear a mask. If you feel more comfortable wearing a mask, because there are some members of our population who feel comfortable with that, and then others who will not be wearing masks. We are prepared with masks in either way. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you come, I don't know if you live this way, but, you know, I got a mask in my pocket and I walk out and said, am I masked here? Am I not masked?
I know,
Okay, we're masked. And it's kind of working through that environment. But I think I'm speaking for all professional theater companies that way. And we've seen that actually in other community theater houses also navigating that same type of process. The biggest thing I would recommend to everybody who's going to the theater is we're pulling for these artists.
Yeah,
we want this to happen. This is sometimes the cost of having live professional actors on the stages, and we want to do what we can to make everybody safe and feel amenable and happy in giving them that. And so I love our festival audiences, very understanding, really, really, really wonderful in seeing through the process. And we rejoiced 2 weeks ago when the outdoor mandate was lifted.
Yeah.
And then we started on the next mandate, saying, okay, what can we do to make this happen? And I really believe that'll happen. We presently, when I was talking to our marketing department, they said, you know, make sure people understand. At this point, we are one of the largest theater companies that is opening with the largest array of plays. And there are some of our friends in other theater companies who have not had that privilege. Mm-hmm. So we're saying that with a bit of humility, saying we know kind of because of where we are and the protocols that we've had in place and the funders that have kind of allowed this type of thing to happen, there are other theater companies across the nation who may be starting with one-person plays.
Yeah, with one at a time. And so certainly we'll be looking to you as this rolls out to see what happens. Thank you so much for your time, Michael. Michael Barr is the Executive Director and Education Director at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. And it's beginning its 60th anniversary season this summer. You can check them out at Utah Shakespeare. Now, coming up next, we're going to discuss ways to strengthen the stability of your relationships. Thanks for listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Does negative news make you feel pessimistic about the future? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to learn what actions to take to help make the world a little bit brighter starting today. And then, do you think you know the McDonald's menu by heart? Well, I'm going to tell you about a treat you didn't know you needed on their secret menu. That's 15 minutes away in your morning buzz.
We often hear about the importance of building a strong foundation, and this principle applies to everything, our homes, our habits, and most importantly, in our relationships. A good relationship is the kind that will stand the test of time. It's built on trust, and it's built on love. Also, it's built on mutual respect. But what else makes a solid foundation for our relationships? To share their secrets of stability, we've asked back into The Lisa Show Danielle and Howard Taylor from Marriage on Deck. They are the marriage coaches and authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Marriage. Welcome back, Danielle and Howard.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
All right, Danielle, to you, I would like you to define for me stability as we talk about it in a relationship. What is it?
Stability in a relationship has two arms. The first one is the spiritual arm. If you're a spiritual person or religious person, stability is connecting with your religious hierarchy, committing to them, praying, fasting, reading the word, like that type of thing. Mm-hmm. That's the foundation for us if you're a religious person, right? If you're a non-religious person, and in addition to religious, basically, stability is just getting on the same page, having a foundation. A house divided against itself cannot stand. So if we develop values and declarations and mission statements and affirmations, things that basically matter most to us, and come into agreement with those things, and then committing to them, that I think will help couples establish the foundation for stability in their relationship.
So how, Howard, as we're establishing that foundation, what does that look like? We you're coaching a couple that wants to build that foundation. Maybe there's no issues within it. How do you recommend that they voice or put into place that foundation?
Yeah. So for Danielle and I, I'll share, and what we coach couples on is we kind of take couples through practical steps. And so that developing out your foundation, we would call it, is coming up with things that I would say are core values. So core values are incredible to making sure you have something that's a guideline or a benchmark for your relationship. For Danielle and I, it was called the Ten Commandments of our marriage. And so we listed out these core values or these things that were very important to us that acted as an accountability partner outside of just the she or I. So, okay, it's written down that we have the Ten Commandments of our marriage. Because we've written that down, which we ought to do, don't just talk about it, document it somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now when Danielle or I breach one of those core values or commandments, we use that as the judge and jury, right?
Okay.
Not what Howard thinks now in his current season. It's also important to have mottos and mission statements or impact statements documented somewhere, because these things are great reminders to you as you go through your day. We know marriage presents many, many things that act as distractions, maybe to what our core values are. Whether it is something we're excited about, maybe it makes me want to quit my job, but a core value for us is financial stability, and so I can't just come home and tell my wife I quit. Right?
Mm-hmm.
These things help your marriage not fall or falter, as Dan said. A house divided against itself can't stand. And so also one of the visual things we do is we take couples through a quick visual exercise. And we say, think about the strong marriages or the power couples that you revere or reverence. Just, you know, visualize that couple. In marriages, we always have these couples that we think, oh, maybe it's our mother and father that have been married for 35 years, or somebody at our church, or somebody in our community. Well, we call those skyscraper marriages, right?
Hmm.
And so whenever you see a skyscraper marriage, it's tall, it looks great, they look happy, they've been married a long time. When we remind couples that the foundation of a skyscraper is oftentimes deeper or just as deep as what you see above ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in order for that couple to have gotten to the point of being a skyscraper marriage, they had to dig a deep, solid foundation based off of core values, principles, disciplines, and practices, and then continue to have staying power or consistency with that foundation. And so that's one of the visual exercises that we take couples through, in addition to documenting core values and boundaries.
You know, as you're talking, there's an old Sunday school song that comes to my mind. I'm not sure if in your faith tradition that you know it, but the song essentially goes, the foolish man built his house upon the sand, the foolish man built his house upon the sand, right? It's one that the younger kids would sing, and the house on the sand washed away, right? And the principal obviously is building on a sure foundation. Danielle, what are those principles or foundations of sand that we fall ourselves trapping into?
I think we find ourselves being trapped into not being prioritizing each other, not being focused on what the mission and value is, not respecting each other, not valuing the time that we have, not appreciating who we are as individuals and what we bring and contribute to the marriage. I mean, I probably could go on and on, but some of those things, I think, is some of those things cause us to have not have a firm foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we start missing the mark, you know, being testy and temperamental and not adhering to the goals and the commandments and the vision, like all of those things, I feel like contribute to having a sand under your relationship.
Now,
under your relationship.
We're visiting with Danielle and Howard Taylor. They are marriage coaches, authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Marriage. You guys work with couples. And I would suppose that the conversation would go something like this. Hey, would you guys like to have a stable marriage? Would you like to have stability in your marriage? I can't imagine that anyone would be like, nah, not interested. but I do imagine that they... When people work with coaches, it is oftentimes because they have found themselves in some element of a shaky foundation. So, Howard, what are the things that you've learned in the time that you've done this? What are some secrets or some helps, some hacks that you can offer in our time with you guys today?
Yeah, sure. one hack is just that you mentioned it there. We believe that there's safety in the multitude of counselors, and so. We think that there's some level of dangers in having an isolated marriage where there's not somebody, whether it's a coach or a marriage mentor, that's been where you're going and that could help you navigate that space. And so we encourage all to align themselves with a spiritual marriage coach or a mentor. And these individuals, it's important to note, shouldn't just be in your life when you have problems, right? Similar to the sports arena where even though you may be the greatest basketball player, baseball player, or football player, there's still a coach that helps bring that out of you. And so very important for marriages, especially those that are new, to tap into a mentor or coach. In addition to that, it is always important. Dale and I call it relationship performance evaluation. As you build on stability, you've maybe documented those boundaries that we talked about earlier. How often do you revisit that? And so in the workplace, if you're going to be a stable employee, if you're right and you have a boss that really cares about your growth and succession plan, they sit you down on a periodic basis, whether it's semi-annually or annually, and they go over how you're performing to those boundaries or for Dale and I, our 10 commandments. And so it's very important for couples to document that, put that on schedule. Mm-hmm. And by putting that on schedule, what it'll allow your couple to your spouse or your partner to become is your accountability partner. And it also, because I would say a pitfall to a firm foundation is when you get in the cycle or habit of always pointing out weaknesses, mm-hmm. and always nitpicking and all what that does is it sometimes puts cracks in your foundation. Whereas if you have a definitive time to talk about constructive criticism because it's on calendar, first and foremost, the spouse or partner expects to get some, just like I would in the workplace, I expect to get some constructive criticism. Hmm. But also it allows for you to meet that constructive criticism with even more praise. We know that a good accountability partner or boss or coach, though they're going to give you constructive criticism, they match and balance out that diet equally with praise. And so two things, have a mentor for your marriage as a hack always, and don't just think that it's when you're struggling, and have relationship performance evaluations as a unique opportunity to grow your marriage and keep a firm foundation.
One thing that comes to mind as we're talking, and I love the visualization of a foundation. Where I live is in a particular neighborhood where there's a tremendous amount of gentrification, or people are tearing down homes and rebuilding homes. And so I wonder, in the cases of things like infidelity or financial infidelity or those things, that's almost like completely... you know, taking out that home, if our relationships are those home, I'm air quoting that. Is it possible then to build a home of the same or even better quality in the place where that once foundation stood? Danielle?
Absolutely. Once you identify what the issues are and kind of isolate it, you can focus on rebuilding from the ground up. Howard always talks about a good example of a home remodel. You tear it all down, you build down, you tear down the walls, you do all of this stuff, and then you go back and graph out, what do I want this home to look like, the home of our marriage? What do we want the upgrades to be? What do we want the interior to look like, the exterior to look like? How do we want to rebuild this to become something that we love and are proud of? And so just because you hit a bump in the road doesn't mean it's like, oh, let's just tear the house down and be done. Of course, take the time to build it back up and then look at where the holes were. How did we get to that point to begin with last time so that we can be prepared to fight better against it this time, to to ward off any type of attacks from the relationship, from whatever area they may be, to make the foundation secure and strong and stable. So absolutely, you can rebuild it back up to make it exactly the marriage that you need to be. Nobody that you want it to be. No one has a perfect marriage per se, but you can, not per se. Nobody has a perfect marriage, but you can create a marriage that you are happy with, and that's ultimately what matters most.
I want to take this example of the home, the being rebuilt, the being renovated, one step further to just sort of ask around this. Several of us, what we know about relationships is what we gained by observing them in our home of origin. So I liken that to maybe we've moved into a home and there's a wall that doesn't make sense that's in the middle of our family room. How do we deal with those as we're talking about this stability and this closeness in a relationship?
That's awesome. I love that example, because when we coach couples, we literally tell them there's a segment after we first have couples define what they want their remodeled marriage or home to look like, right? You're using that same example. But then it's very critical when you watch HGTV or all these remodel shows to open up your marriage by tearing down walls. And so we talk about that tear down process with couples. And we have these couples mutually list out walls that they feel like need to and have to come down in the relationship. Now, the beauty of what we call demolition in the marriage is, though it's loud and it's boisterous and it may cause us to have to change habits in our relationship, for the most part, it's relatively quick. But you have to be agreed to tear them down. And so we have couples list out these walls that have to come down, and then we assist them in tearing that down with what that looks like. So if there was pornography in a relationship, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to tear down the wall of pornography in a relationship, that means that you have to retrofit and put beams and do things to make sure that the house is still stable with that wall being out of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's being mindful of cell phone usage. Maybe it's being mindful of that addiction and seeking additional help, right? It's important to anchor on something else. And so, because if not, other walls may erect themselves. And so I love the wall example, because it's important to tear down walls, but it's also important to anchor your marriage or your house, the home of your marriage, on some other things. And that comes through the design process. What is our marriage going to look like now that we've torn these walls out?
Danielle, without breaching the confidence that you've had with people that you've worked with, I'm wondering if you could share an example where you were able to help sort of shore up a wall of a relationship.
Yeah, for sure. We talked to a couple one time where one party came in with a single mindset, and another party came in, the other spouse, I should say, came into the marriage with like a hero mindset. So there were some issues that had built up over time where it caused them to have a couple of cracks in their foundation, from not being able to communicate, from not being able to understand each other, from one person spoiling the other one and then getting resentful over it later on, to how they projected themselves on social media, just a host of different things. So like Howard mentioned, We help them to tear those down by asking, what is the problem? Number one, what's the problem? Because a side note from all of that is that sometimes we have small things here and there, but we want to tear down the whole entire house. It's like, just because you don't like the paint on the wall doesn't mean you tear down the whole house and run out, you know?
Exactly.
Maybe let's just start there. We can repaint this wall. There's hope, you know? So that was the thing too, just really isolating it, getting to the heart of what the actual issues were. Sometimes the small things turn into big things, and then it just confuses everybody. So helping them realize what that is, talking about what they want it to look like, and then coming up with a plan on how they can do that. What is the frequency that is going to be done? Who's going to hold you accountable? Are we able to get in there and hold you accountable? When we ask you, we expect an answer regarding how you're working towards these things. Like, there's no point in counseling and coaching couples if there's no accountability and commitment and follow through with that. Mm-hmm. And so for us, just getting with them and holding them accountable and talking to them about how to tear that down, how to go day to day after you're long gone from talking to us, because things can sound great on the phone or, you know, Zoom or whatever in person with these meetings and coaching and counseling, but how do I go through my day to day after I'm done with you all? So strategizing and coming up with effective practices that they could put into motion to start rebuilding those things that were causing issues was paramount and important for them.
Danielle and Howard Taylor, certified marriage coaches, founders of Marriage on Deck, which you can find on social media. You can also find their new book, The Fundamentals of Marriage, on their website, marriageondeck.com. This is conversation number two in a series that we'll do all year long as we go through each of the chapters in their book to be able to help build a stronger and more lasting relationship. Thanks, you guys, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Coming up next, how to stop letting negative news pull you down. And coming up in your morning buzz, the stuff you didn't think you needed, but now you listen. There's a secret menu. It's from McDonald's. I'm going to give you all of the intel that's coming up next. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Have you been keeping up with Lisa's Adventure Club? Well, in 20 minutes, we're going to travel to Canada to visit Ed Ziaizo Provincial Park. We're excited to tell you that as part of Lisa's Adventure Club. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Lisa V. That's right. I'm taking over the morning buzz today and bringing you three stories, three kind of ideas that you're going to want to talk about. Kind of buzz around about that water cooler talk that makes you sound informed and interesting. There's a lull in the conversation. Don't worry. We got some ideas of things to talk about today. The first one, you know, we always say celebrities, they're just like us. But I don't know. This story that's trending makes me rethink that. Selma Hayek recently on a new interview with Kelly Clarkson said that she was really confused when she tried Taco Bell for the first time. You know, she grew up in Mexico when she visited her aunt in Houston, Texas. She went to Taco Bell and she's like, they gave us these hard shell tacos. I've never seen that in my life. They don't exist in Mexico. It's always with a soft taco. Well, in this interview that's trending, she talks about how it just was really, really confusing. And I just think, okay, a celebrity's going to sound really out of touch if they say they don't understand Taco Bell. Now, according to a deep dive into the history of the taco, which, of course, I had to take, some people say, listen, it's inspired by Tacos Dorados, fried tacos from Mexico, which date back to the 1890s. So, yeah, they did exist in Mexico. Another story reports that crispy tacos were popular in Texas and California in the early 1940s. Now, Glenn Bell, who would later become the founder of Taco Bell, started selling them in the 1950s chain restaurant called Tacotillo, which later became Taco Bell. Now, also, you know, on this day in history, June 17th, but in 1885, today marks the day that the Statue of Liberty was delivered. You know, it was our nice 151-foot-high gift from the French people. It arrived in New York. There was a lot of brouhaha, if you will, about the base and who was going to pay for that pedestal. It went back and forth, and ultimately, Joseph Pulitzer of the New York World started a donation drive, and it got a lot of contributors to donate the $102,000 that were needed at the time to make the pedestal. Now, on that pedestal is inscribed the poem, you know, you've heard it, by Emma Lazarus. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. That's on this day in history. And finally, maybe you've heard a lot of fast food restaurants have a secret menu. Did you know McDonald's has a secret menu? Well, what dessert can you order? Well, thanks to a popular TikTok user, Kaylee Weeks, she posted a video claiming that at McDonald's, you can get $9 chocolate cakes with white frosting and an image of Ronald McDonald. That's right. McDonald's sells birthday cakes for $9 on its secret menu. Now, when they asked, is this really true? And McDonald's, the spokespeople, came out and said, listen, yeah, but they're not available at every location. You kind of have to ask. But you know what? Like my dad always told me growing up, if you don't ask, it's not going to happen. There's no harm in asking, right? So occasionally, the restaurants have decided to let customers purchase this cake for their birthdays. They're not on the official menu. I got to get I got to get to the bottom of this, though, because like a birthday cake from McDonald's, why not? With the image of Ronald McDonald on it, $9. Now, lots of restaurants have secret menus. If you didn't know, Disney Springs announced it has a secret menu, a watermelon dole that's going to be available for a limited time. Starbucks has a secret menu, In-N-Out, Chipotle. So, you know, next time you go out, maybe this weekend, ask for a secret item menu. Maybe the employees will know, but at least maybe they won't. But at least you know it's possible. Maybe not at every location, but having your dream birthday cake ordered from McDonald's may actually be a dream no more and be a reality. And that is your morning buzz. Now, switching gears a little bit, you've probably heard of the old African proverb that talks a little bit about, you know, after a storm, a beach was littered with starfish and one man walked down and picked up that starfish one at a time and chucked it back in the ocean. Another man walks by and scoffs, "Well, you'll never be able to save all the starfish out here," to which the wise man responds, "Yes, I know. But to the one that I have thrown back, I've made all the difference." So how does this proverb sort of relate to us? I feel like we share this a lot as if we all collectively understand what it means, and that you kind of just can't give up if you and worry too much about your total impact, but just trust that any impact, like small, will have a big effect on a one-to-one level. And we really live in a complex world with a lot of problems. And I only laugh a little bit just because I think that we are collectively feeling overwhelmed by all of it. Watching the news and thinking about what's going on in our personal lives or with our families and friends, it's easy to say, you know, this is too much. And what effect can I really have? So what are the things that we can really do to make the world a little bit better for those around us? Well, today we're inviting into this conversation friend of the show and motivational speaker and author Gaina Linkondi to talk about her acronym of HELP, H-E-L-P, and how it can help make the world just a little bit better one step at a time. Welcome, Gaina Lin. Thanks for your time.
Hi, friend. How are you?
We're doing okay. You know, looking at the news and things kind of like rolling out, but also yes, knowing that things never really sort of die down as far as like stresses and worries that we have. So I'd love to get your perspective on how you're feeling right now in this moment as a motivational speaker, as someone who likes to encourage others. Are you feeling a little overwhelmed?
Well, you know, I have attended a few events this month in speaking and done some conferences, especially with some marginalized groups, and people are feeling the heaviness of individual worry. And I love your intro and that analogy or that parable of picking up the starfish, because if we get too overwhelmed, I think we are forced into inactivity, mm-hmm, in that mindset that it doesn't matter what we do, we can't really solve the big problems. And I hope this acronym takes a complex issue or a broad concept of HELP and breaks it down in a memorable way so that we see that we are helping. I feel like people in general, I'm saying a big generalization, mm-hmm, here, they want to do good.
Yeah.
They want to help. They want to be part of moving things forward. I think the average person on the planet wants to be a good citizen,
yeah,
and help their neighbor and extend kindness when they can. And so I hope this is a feel good, but it also breaks it down that it starts with us individually. Margaret Mead said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has."
Yeah.
And I think if you look at anything that has ever shifted the needle or moved the ball down the field, whatever analogy you want to use.
You know, I love a good sports analogy.
I know. And it starts with a couple of people saying, "Hey, look, there's a problem. There's a need. Let's take care of it." And so I think the first in the acronym is H. What does H mean? H means that help comes in many different forms. Sometimes we think help is eliminating the problem altogether, that somehow the outcome dictates whether or not we've done any good or help anyone in need.
And yeah, we want to see results. We want to say, yeah, okay, I worked really hard to help somebody, so this is the result. It worked.
Right.
So when we don't see that, it can make us feel like our efforts aren't effective.
Right. But I think you and I have been public about some really traumatic personal losses and struggles in our own lives. And I would say that people have come to my aid and helped me, but they didn't eliminate the problem. It didn't take it away. It definitely helped me along the way. And so I think the first thing we need to understand is that help comes in so many forms. Mm-hmm. Get bigger in your thinking about it. Maybe it's donating to a GoFundMe account. Maybe it's making sure you have time with someone and you reach out and text them. Maybe it's posting about a cause that you care about so that other people are aware. Maybe it's prayer. I believe in the power of prayer, and that's not religion specific. And so I received messages from friends that say, you were in my prayers this morning, and that got me through the day. Maybe it's just having an awareness for a neighbor or a need that has come up that, you know, right now where we live in the state of Utah, there's a severe drought happening. And I know there's other areas across the country that are dealing with drought issues. And so there's been discussion in our home of like, what can we do? Where can we adjust our watering? You know, maybe no one's going to notice what we do. But I think that mindset of being more expansive than restrictive is a really hopeful way to talk about helping.
Yeah. And when we talk about help, too, it's important. I know that you just speak about this, to accept help as well. How do you sort of help people learn how to accept help when they're not good at it?
So there was a video that went viral a couple of weeks ago of a police officer who was stopped somewhere at a fast food place. Maybe there was a secret recipe menu that he didn't know about. But
that he just had to get to.
Yeah. But you were
get that sheet cake. Yeah.
If you missed the segment I'm referring to, you may think I went off the rails there. But this young boy came up and had his little change, and he wanted to buy a meal for this officer, and it makes me emotional to think about. And the officer pushed him away and said, oh, I'm good. He was on a call about a case. He got back on social media and said, I need to find this boy, because that was not okay. He was trying to help me. And one of the things that would have helped the world is me allowing him to help me.
Yeah.
And they were eventually reconnected and they were able to do that. So I think that's a really good question. It's not always easy to receive the help. I think both of us would say it's easier to be the helper than it is to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
But it is where I believe the fabric of families and friendships and our communities are built. And so it is a give and take. And so when we talk about what is help, think about what has been done for you that was effective. I think oftentimes, you know, we often don't know what someone else's love language is, but I know that you and I've had conversations before. Sometimes people well-meaning don't do things that are helpful. And so if you're stuck and you don't know how to help, think about what people have done for you in the past that was effective. And then I think that question goes right into the fact that the E in the analogy or in the acronym is that every single person in society is dealing with an issue. Just assume that everyone you're driving on the freeway with today, that you're going to work with, that you're, you know, talking to, is dealing with something. Stop assuming that you know who are the ones that are in need and those that are not. Whether it's addiction, anxiety, depression, which I really appreciate talking about mental health needs. I think the pandemic created a global need conversation. Everyone is dealing with some issue in their lives. And so you don't have to look that far. It's not an us and them. It's not like, well, this group of people are doing great. The other group of people on the other side of the street, man, they are really struggling. I really think it's helpful to consider that everyone around us have needs going on, and everyone is affected by something.
Yeah.
And that leads us to the L. What does L stand for? I think when we're talking about some of these big issues, like a drought or mental health issues or addiction, it can be super, super overwhelming. And so I love to bring in another analogy. If I turn on off all the lights and one little light on my cell phone is on, everyone in the room can see it, especially when you're trying to watch a movie, right?
Right.
So I think that analogy is super helpful. Mm. That where do I need to turn up the light in my life so I can be a part of that solution? It's the lame oxygen on the plane analogy, that if you don't get the oxygen first, you have nothing to give. And we've talked a lot on this show, you and I, and about the fact that there's certain ways in which you can turn up the light in your life.
Yeah, let's talk about some specific ones, because I think that a lot of people think, I hear this a lot, like be the light, be the change, and help, but they feel overwhelmed or they feel sort of small about that. And I'm wondering the practical ways that you find that people are able to do that, not just in their families, but in their communities or their work environment.
Yeah, so I feel like the most boundaried people are the most loving people. And so the people that in my life that I know will create a boundary for what they can or cannot do are the people, ironically or not ironically, that I will reach out for help. So right now, currently, my schedule has been insane. And yesterday, full disclosure, I did not get out of my pajamas. I worked completely from home, and that was about as much rest as I could have. I had to say no to a few things because I had a big work project all day yesterday. So is there something in your life you need to say no to say yes to something else? Mm-hmm. And I talked about that on the show. Where is your individual life getting low? And so what does support look like for you, whether that's therapy, whether that's exercise, meditation, or play? Where are you making sure the light is still happening within your life so that you can start there? Then that help that you want to give, that I think we all want to give, is given probably first within our homes. Then it goes into maybe our work and our communities, and then the world. And so I know it sounds super cliche, but being the change you want to see in the world, it starts about right in front of you, and right within you. And so where are you? I did a post on social media a couple weeks ago where I was frustrated with the news headlines. I was frustrated with the vitriol. I was frustrated with the negativity and the anger. And I was starting to become a little like not just Eeyore, but like angry girl, inside. And I thought, no, I'm going to be what I want to see more of. And really within a day, I started to feel differently. Like, I wanted to see more kindness, so I tried that day to be intentional about that.
Well, it's an interesting idea to say, in response to feeling overwhelmed, I am just going to do what I can be responsible for. And so I appreciate you being able to talk about that. H is the help, and it comes in many forms. E, everyone's affected by worries and all of these issues in society, and we're all connected. And the L is that light chases the dark. It doesn't, eliminate the problems, but that you can be that sort of change. And so I'm wondering what the P stands for in your acronym.
It's to end on a high note. P stands for the possibilities that those small singular efforts, those contributions, those little steps, it's the little things. Really, we have had a conversation of cliches, but it is the little things that make the difference. So whether it's paying for someone behind you in line today, whether it's changing your watering schedule on your lawn to help with the drought, or donating to a GoFundMe account today, do one thing. Be more kind, be more helpful, or receive the help, and then see how that small change really does ripple out. And I really think that what we look for, we see more of. Mm-hmm. And maybe the more we see today of the possibilities of ways we're going to help, we will stop feeling so discouraged and overwhelmed that there's nothing improving or changing in our world.
We speak sort of collectively as a community, I think, and particularly nationally, of, well, there's just so much bombardment with negative news or just feeling overwhelmed, and it's important, and we need to be informed, and we need to solve these horrible problems. And it is true, but I also feel that in order to not only deal with it, but be able to start and make a change, we have to know what to do when we're feeling overwhelmed. And I will say anecdotally, on the days that I've been the most overwhelmed, if I can go to bed saying, well, at least I did that one thing, I had that good conversation with a friend, or I did that really nice thing for my daughter, or I did that, I made that one little contribution to a GoFundMe or whatever. It does sort of ease that nagging in my brain of like, everything's going to be so horrible forever. It's at least I did that one thing.
Right. And I think that's so important, because really we only have today. You and I know that life can change on a moment's notice. And I really have realized for my own mental health and what I'm passionate about talking about is that I only have really any influence on the moment ahead of me right now, not the moment ahead of me 2 hours from now or even 2 days from now. So it's our future thinking that gets us in trouble. So when we do break it down to, what did I do today? I try to end the day each day rewriting just one line in what is a journal, basically, and where I saw that one thing, that one area of my life where it was effective, or it felt hopeful, or I felt connection, or I felt some faith in my life. And that's how I try to end the day. And then I try to write the five things in the morning I'm grateful for before I start the day. And when I do those things, it really is, we have today. That's all we have. Mm-hmm. And so often we think we know based on today what tomorrow will be. And for good or for bad, we really don't. And so I hope there's one person today, just one person listening to the show, that had a thought of something they wanted to do. We had a situation in our neighborhood with a family that had a really uncomfortable run-in with our HOA, and our neighborhood rallied. And as uncomfortable and unfortunate was for that family, I'm so grateful it happened, because it turned into this movement of community and awareness of the diversity in our neighborhood. And it actually revealed that we had more in common than we had different, and it created community, all because an HOA situation happened that was unfortunate.
A singular small effort can make a big difference, especially if you're feeling negative or feeling overwhelmed. Gaina Lynn Condi, thank you so much for your time today. Now, Gaina Lynn is an author and motivational speaker and great friend for the show. You can get more information about her by going to Gaina Lynn on Twitter. Also, you know, coming up next, we're talking about Lisa's Adventure Club. We've got a new destination you're going to want to consider as you enter for a chance to win. Thanks for listening to The Lisa Show. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Club. The Lisa Club. Now, listen, the reason why I'm saying that is because Lisa's Adventure Club is well underway. We are giving away a National Annual Parks Pass every week this entire summer long as a way for you to get out and have an adventure, you know, with your family, with your friends. Maybe you've been cooped up with the same people, but you just want to be with them in a different location, or grab a different group of people and have a little bit of an adventure. You know, this is what Lisa's Adventure Club is all about. You just go to byuradio.org/adventure to enter for a chance to win. This week, you can enter for a chance with a little extra help, a little extra boost by entering in the secret word, which this week is boots. That'll give you a little bit more chance to win. Now, today for Lisa's Adventure Club, we're heading all the way to British Columbia to visit Mount, it actually is Mount Ediza, which I have never heard of before preparing for this. And so I'm interested in seeing what this provincial park is going to be like. So we're inviting in on the conversation Mike Shao. In 2014, Mike co-led an expedition across the Spectrum Mountain Range and Mount Ediza. And the team included Mike and his wife, Chantel, his friend Eric, and members of the Talta Nation, and he's here with us today to speak about this expedition specifically and what we might see. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you for having me on the show here.
I appreciate it, and I'd love for you to describe this kind of like a trek and journey that you set out on in 2014.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, first of all, you have to imagine where this place is located. I mean, the province of British Columbia is vast. It's huge. I mean, you drive 20 hours north from Vancouver. This is where we live in Vancouver in the southern end. And 20 hours north, you're still in the same province. You know, if we were to drive 20 hours south, we would be probably in Mexico. You know, uh-huh. So the province is massive. And then to get to this park, we had to first of all fly, you know, about halfway across the province, and then drive another 8 hours north. Take a float plane into this little lake, and then we hiked another 10 days in. So, it, you know,
wow.
it's very far out there, but it's beautiful. It's just an amazing spot.
Well, could you describe what it looks like? I had never been familiar with it, and so I'm so curious as to what drew you to Mount Edziza and why, of all the places that you would go there, and what you saw.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, well, first of all, growing up on the West Coast here in Canada, I've been in love with mountains since I was a child. Mm. You know, I've explored mountains around the coastal ranges here, down into the Rockies, you know, around the world. My wife and I went to Mount Kilimanjaro back in 2010. We, you know, spent some time in the Swiss Alps and many trips to the Himalaya. So I've kind of, you know, seen these various different mountain environments. Mount Edziza and the surrounding areas, the Spectrum Range, they're not the highest mountains, but they are some of the most unique mountains I have ever seen.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, all the other places I had seen around the world, these different mountain environments, I never was anywhere where, you know, this kind of the mountain environment, the surrounding areas weren't somehow impacted by human presence. So one thing about this Mount Edziza area is that it is one of the last naturally intact, you know, wild places on Earth.
Mm.
And so that was one of the big draws. But second of all, the terrain is extremely varied. Again, the Spectrum Range, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of volcanic activity that have formed these mountains, and they're basically all colors, from these deep red, purplish, green,
oh, really?
Yellow hues. Yeah, I mean, it's like a rainbow almost. I mean, you see the pictures, and it's just, it looks like something like you're on Mars or something. You know, when we were trekking through that area, so it was a 10-day traverse over these two ranges. We were picking up chunk sizes of copper oxide, iron oxide, you know, big boulders of obsidian, you know, just every mineralized kind of rock you can imagine, you know, was up there.
Wow.
So there was this one slope I remember we climbed up, and it was just littered with, you know, those geodes,
mm-hmm.
those rocks with the kind of the crystals inside. I mean, just littered, like the whole hillside was sparkling, just lit up by the sun. So it was, I've never seen anything like that before. And then you have Mount Edziza itself, which is this massive volcano, glaciers coming off of it in every direction. And that in itself is, just a sight to see.
Wow. If you're just joining in on the conversation, we're talking with Mike Shao about Mount Edziza Provincial Park and the expedition that he went, knowing that a lot of people aren't really going to be able to see it because, like you said, it's one of the last naturally like intact places. Typically, how many people do visit this area, and do you plan to go back?
Well, I mean, this was back in 2014 when we did this traverse. I had never talked to anyone other than this Tahltan leader, Curtis, who we had done the traverse with. Part of the journey was to walk together to co-lead this expedition with members of the Tahltan, because this entire area is in the Tahltan lands. You know, that's the First Nation tribe that's up there. So part of the reason was we wanted to kind of do it together, learn from them, observe, and, you know, see how they kind of perceive their lands. I had never met anyone else who had done that traverse.
Yeah.
Since then, many people have contacted me about my GPS coordinates and that.
Really?
So I know many people have gone back and repeated the traverse. A lot of people more people visit sort of the north end of the park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come in from we came from the south. We landed in this little lake. You could hardly call it a lake because it was so small. But the pilot, he actually told us that he could not take off from the lake with us in the plane. So he's like, you guys are on your own now. I'll have to see you 10 days north from here. So,
oh, my word.
We couldn't even fly out if we wanted to. But if you come in from the north, I know more people do that. And you don't have to do the whole traverse across the mountains there.
How long did it take you?
So the traverse itself took 10 days.
Okay.
And a lot of it was navigation. I mean, we made some critical navigational errors because there's no trails or anything. You know, we just had to go reading the land. And
wow.
Part of the challenge was, you know, from a mountaineering perspective, I view the land a certain way. But Curtis, you know, we were co-leading together, and he reads the land very differently, right? So he kind of follows the caribou. So we would often, we'd have these differences of opinions of where we should go. And sometimes that got us into a little bit of trouble.
Let's follow the caribou. I can just imagine that conversation. Say what? Hmm? Come again? Well, it's such an interesting experience that you've had that few people have, and I love being able to highlight kind of the idea of it. So if people are trying to get like a fuller idea of, I mean, this volcanic mountain range and the different things that they can see, what was your favorite part, you know, kind of that hidden gem that you just always will remember?
Yeah, I think, you know, it really comes down to the richness of the land. I mean, the land is alive. You could almost feel the pulse of it being out there. And there were points where, you know, you'd step somewhere and you'd step on a piece of moss or something, and you'd almost feel bad, like, oh my God, I'm almost polluting. It was just, you could just feel that untouchedness of the whole place, and you could see it in the wildlife. I mean, you know, we saw this, I remember one day we saw this grizzly, this big grizzly bear with four cubs just running across the plateau. And you know, another day, this big bull caribou just stopped us in our tracks, so magnificent and proud. And it wasn't even afraid of us. It just, you know, there were several of us, and it just kind of stopped right in front of us and stood there just observing us. You know, and we were drinking the water. I mean, the water for 10 days, you know, you think about the water mineralized and purified by thousands of years of volcanic activity and all the minerals up there. You know, I felt my body getting stronger from drinking that water.
Really?
Drinking that water.
Huh.
It was the wildest thing. I mean, I think, you know, if you had to ask me, the thing that I'll remember the most is just the aliveness of the land out there.
Wow. I'm wondering if you can take us back to that moment where you've had this adventure, you've seen these things that most people will never get to see, you know, stepped on moss that no one has ever stepped on ever before, you know, an experience that few people get. How did it feel when you were done, when you had completed that expedition after all of that planning and the hard work and the traversing were over and you completed? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was extremely rewarding, I think mostly because, there was the whole experience on the land and getting through some of the physical challenges, but doing it with the members of the Tall Ten was extremely special. You know, I mean, we had to see, you know, each other's perspective and respect each other on a whole nother level. Like, every day I was kind of checking my ego at the door, just working together to get through it. The only way I think we got through it together was, you know, through this deeper level of respect for each other. And Curtis and I have since become, you know, really good friends, and other members who are on the team, you know, learning from them, their ways, their stories, the stories that are embedded in the land. You know, I remember there was this one part where we were kind of traversing alongside Mount Idzaidza, and because of the many years ago of volcanic lava flow, it's created these hollow caverns under the ground. So when you're walking on the ground, it almost feels like your footsteps are like thundering under the ground.
Oh, wow.
And Curtis, you know, he told me that is part of the connection to his ancestors, because his ancestors who were hunting in that same area, you know, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, would have heard those same footsteps. So that to him is kind of, you know, connecting him to his ancestors. So just, you know, how the stories are embedded into the land, and then hearing the stories from them, from the members of the Tall Ten on the land while we were there, doing the journey together, having that respect for each other, you know, achieving some sort of level of new unity in a way. You know, that to me was the most important thing about this whole thing.
Wow. Oh, I appreciate you taking the time to share that with us. Where are you traveling next?
Well, my wife and I, we haven't been to the Himalayan in a little while. That's a whole other story, but we went back we've been going back to the Himalaya in Nepal every 8 to 10 months since 2012, and we had uncovered a kind of a karmic connection with a little girl out there in this village at 14,000 feet in the far off the beaten path.
Wow.
That was back in 2012. So over the next 10 years, almost, we've been, you know, kind of growing our relationship with this little girl. Her name is Karma, and her family. And so we want to, because of COVID, we haven't been able to see them. So we want to go back and see them as soon as we can here.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for being here.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Yeah, great pleasure.
That was Michael Shao, who led a co-expedition to the Spectra Mountain Range at Mount Edizaiza. And to find out more about him, you can visit michaelshao.com. And don't forget, as part of Lisa's Adventure Club, we're giving away an annual National Parks Pass every week throughout the whole summer. It's not too late to enter for a chance to win. Go to BYURadio.org to enter. I hope you win. And at the end of the summer, we're giving away a grand prize where we're going to throw in a $500 Visa gift card. So you're not going to want to put that off. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, and you can find everything you need on our BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on SiriusXM channel 143. And if you liked something that you heard on the show, you want to go back, hear it again, maybe share it with a friend, share it on social media, and you can find that podcast wherever you download your podcasts. Now, on tomorrow's show, we're going to focus on fathers for this upcoming Father's Day. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.
And I'll never forget, he said to me, God is a person. That just ran through my head over and over. It was real to me for the first time in my life.
On In Good Faith, it's our privilege to hear stories and accounts from believers told in their own words. Our hope is to listen with an open heart, celebrating the power of faith and belief and what those stories mean to the ones who tell them. From the Krishna temples of Utah, Charu Das, In Good Faith, this Sunday on BYU Radio.
Take BYU Radio on the go with our new app, or download episodes using your favorite podcast platform. In Utah, listen at 89.1 KBYU FM HD2 Provo, or at 107.9 KUMT Randolph-Ogden Salt Lake Provo, and nationally on SiriusXM channel 143, BYU Radio.